So, traditionalism. Actually, I thought the worship was really great today. I had a text from Julian on Friday saying, just had a thought, do you want any hymns on Sunday? So I texted back and said, now I know how much you love them. because actually, that's my point with sort of my thoughts today about traditionalism. I'm not trying to make any point about inclusion of hymns for the sake of including hymns. But what we're looking at is what that first song said, actually, about finding freedom. How do we find freedom in Christ through ritual and tradition? So, my background, quite interesting. My family are, I remember I once asked my dad as a little girl, what are we? Because we'd heard about Protestants, Catholics, and I was like, well, what are we? And he said, we're charismatic evangelicals who worship at an Anglican church. I'm thinking, what does that mean? But it was great. And so for me, the sort of trappings of a C of E church are very familiar, but they don't create any barrier for me, because I can remember fond memories, playing around the Lord's table, some rolling game down the steps at the end of the services. And, you know, I had a dad who was a charismatic evangelical, happy to worship in an Anglican church, happy to wear the robes if that's what needed to be done, but actually took a perverse delight when the bishop came in not telling him which direction Jerusalem was so he could do the blessing at the end. And wouldn't kind of, there was always this kind of gauge with dad as to how far would he go down that road and how far did he think, actually, no, we're veering away from scripture. So that's that. And also, some of you know, I'm actually a historian, did history at university, absolutely loved medieval church history. So this is kind of playing right to my passions. I'm afraid I've completely and unashamedly indulged myself in preparing this. So as a starting point, the word tradition, when you saw that the sermon this morning was on traditionalism, what images or words does it bring to your minds? Yeah.
The altar.
The altar, yeah.
Liturgy.
Yeah.
Smells and bells.
Smells and bells. Yeah. Yeah. I put some similar things. So I've got, you know, liturgy, sacraments, symbology. Darren found me a really good picture of an incense swinger, which is quite pleased with that one. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What feelings do those pictures evoke? How do you feel when you see those?
Same. History, tradition, and, you know, connection with the past.
Can I identify that?
Yeah.
Restricted,
yeah. Yeah, so I put some, I mean, I didn't spend a long time thinking about this, but, you know, sort of restricted, bored and dull, legalistic, small and unimportant. That's sometimes how I felt in a big cathedral. Irrelevant, old-fashioned. So what I've also got on these next three slides is I found some quotes as to what other people think of tradition. It's quite interesting. Tradition kills originality. How do we feel about that? Is that how we feel? It kills originality. Just because something is traditional is no reason to do it, of course, said Lemony Snicket. Mark Twain, the less there is to justify a tradition, the harder it is to get rid of it. So before we start, I just wanted to say it's very easy to discount a traditional pathway by looking at the negatives. So my assumption is, you know, some people have come here today and immediately will think, we've got to avoid tradition because we can't know God through that. We can merely serve him. We miss the social obligations of the world around us. We could be very judgmental of other people. Or we can deify the rites. I love that. You know, if we put the chairs, if we rip the pews out, revival will come. And I've heard people say that, you know, we've now arrived at this little parish church, you know, but we're going to rip the pews out and then, you know, there's going to be revival. Which is obviously, you know, a big misjudgment, really. So what we need to do is kind of put those feelings and our own backgrounds to one side when approaching the topic to realise and remember Jesus preached freedom from the law, not freedom from tradition, which is very different. And we always have to have that in our mind to have a gauge as to where tradition can slip into legalism. So, tradition is a guide, not a jailer. So, introduction broadly, what we're going to cover is Christian heritage, ritual, symbol, sacrifice, and then application. So moving on to heritage, which is the bit I've completely gone to town on because I love it. I didn't look at Mark's website, interestingly, but obviously it was in the back of my mind as I was doing it. And it is completely self-indulgent because it is a complete pet subject of mine. But, you know, if I use the phrase medieval piety, what are you going to think of?
Monks.
Yeah. 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 See, I think of things like that, images like that, those sort of books. Now, to me, beyond the sort of stereotypical artwork, what this represents is centuries of faithful spirituality. And I think that this pathway is a way that we can cherish and develop our spiritual heritage, because it matters. It will mean it matters to us what all those people did all those years ago. And what I want to do is encourage you to look at it and see today what God would like to reveal to you through those traditions. So let's look beyond the tradition and rejoice in the diversity of Christian heritage and find threads of familiarity. Too often, we can look at these images and think that traditionalism will imply stasis or impassibility, but actually a culture of shared symbols and ritual can remain flexible and varied. So what I want to show you is that people back then, as now, had a real relationship with God. So even back then, I think too often we look at that and we think, oh, these poor, ignorant people, you know, before Cranmer and the Reformation, when everything was whitewashed in the churches and the pulpit was made central, poor them, they were just oppressed, and this was just used to kind of oppress the masses. And I just think, well, actually, that isn't the case. Now, obviously, when you look into this as a historian, it's really difficult. You know, where is the evidence? How do you find evidence of the illiterate masses to know what they thought? Your man on the street, in the legal profession, the man on Clapham Omnibus. You know, what did he think? What did he feel? Did he have a relationship with God, or did he just go because he was told he had to and, you know, just did what he was told, didn't understand what was going on? So what I want to show you is that actually back then, they were as imaginative as we are. So I think quite often we at Network think, we're so different because we're so diverse, because we're imaginative, we're colourful, we're vibrant, we have a drawing board. That's what they had back then. Amazingly, they did dramas and they did plays and they had colour in the churches and it was all vibrant. And the whole of their lives was geared around that and their expression of their spirituality. It's too easy, I think, to scoff at the unenlightened and the superstitious. But God cares, because our reaction to that, I think, often reveals our hearts to him. Now, one of the books I recommend on this is a book I use at university by Eamon Duffy called The Stripping of the Altars. And he was looking at the effect of the Reformation on popular religion and trying to find evidence of the real people's spirituality. What did they experience in a traditional setting? And there's evidence that these people were actually encouraged to engage in private meditation and vivid mental imaginings of God, and to use a traditional pathway to actually have their own relationship to God. So all of this that we've been sold, that, you know, medieval people were told you can only connect with God through your priest, and then you have Luther and the whole priesthood of all believers and all this sort of business. Yeah, okay, there was that up here with the sort of intellectual changes that were going on. Down here on the ground, people were already being encouraged to have their own relationships with God, and that is many and varied. So you've got it in books like this. To make himself present in his thought, as if he saw fully all the things that befell about the cross and the glorious passion of our Lord Jesus. Now, I love this, because the sort of man in the street has always been something I found absolutely fascinating. And one of the other things that we can read, there are some fantastic books out there, one by Carlo Ginzburg, which is transcripts of medieval heresy trials, which is brilliant. Because there's your man on the street, had it for heresy, and there is an inquisition on what was he believing? What was he doing? And was it orthodox, was it not? Absolutely fascinating to sort of read. One of the things I wanted to show you is this slide. I found this quote. So they talk about supernatural warmth which suffused their whole being, feelings of great sweetness and divine love and the hearing of heavenly music, wholly other than earthly music. And I love that. I just think, gosh, there were charismatics back then. You know, there were people sort of focused on higher things, and they were able to have that experience. You know, even they may not have understood all the Latin that was going on around them, God communicated with them. That's what they felt. One of my favourite people from this era is a lady called Marjorie Kemp. And she was born in 1373, so it's Edward III. Woman, married, not highborn, trying to fulfil her duties whilst sustaining a deep and strong spiritual life. Sound familiar or relevant? You know, life was stacked against her, but she was what we call a medieval mystic. They were the charismatic, they were the sort of sensates back then. And they engaged in these supernatural experiences. One of the things she said is this. They do not understand that a longing for Jesus burns in my heart. And I love that. That's not even lost in translation. That is what she said. And there's a book at the time of all that she said. And she was on trial for heresy a lot because of that, because of what she was saying. So what I'm saying is these people, even in a traditional environment, had a spiritual pathway where they had a real and present experience. So Christianity does not fundamentally change from one epoch to the next, although the context in which it operates differs, but the manner it might be expressed. But it's the same God. It's the same God. So moving on to ritual. Obviously, in medieval times, early modern times, you can see that ritual can give meaning and cohesion, sort of stability to people's lives, because it was a sort of insecure and unstable world. And yes, the world's changed now, but we all go through times of personal insecurity and instability, even today. And that's when we might find ourselves looking back to a traditional pathway to help us. There we go. Ha, yes, my nice pictures. So one of the examples I can give of that is when I was at university, I went through a really difficult place. It was a really, really dark time. And I felt very lonely. And even though I was very involved with the Christian Union, it just didn't seem very real. And I found it very difficult to find God at all in that environment. And a lot of it centred around a fear of going to bed at night and a fear of dreams and the spiritual realms when I was asleep. I can remember a friend of mine who I was with at university, he was a little bit different. When I sort of spoke to him first in Freshers Week and said, oh, you know, what are you wanting to do when you finish your maths degree? I feel called to be a priest. And I can remember thinking, oh, gosh, the word priest, he's clearly not a conservative evangelical and sort of taking a step backwards. But I kind of found it fascinating because he's clearly from a very different church background to me. And so I was always kind of interested in sort of the things he would get up to. And I was sharing with him once about this sort of situation I was in. And he said, oh, he said, we're doing a series in the college chapel at the moment on night prayer, Celtic night prayer. You should perhaps come along. And I was a bit, sounds a bit, you know, liturgical. And it was fantastic because when I was in that place where I was so desperate, I didn't have the words to pray my own prayers. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to find God in what I was going through. The one place I could was by going through that pattern every night, the pattern of that sort of Celtic liturgy. There was this little book which he recommended, Prayer at Night's Approaching, I've still got. And it's just the repetition was just really comforting. You know, God bless this city and move our hearts with pity lest we grow hard. God bless this house with silence, solicitude and simplicity that we might pray. God bless these days. And so you go on. You know, God bless the night and calm the people's fright. And I can remember just hearing that and thinking, oh, gosh, other people feel like this. Other people feel like this. And they had the words I needed to cling to. And so the thing I found very difficult, which kind of opened my eyes a bit to how it must feel to follow a more traditional pathway, is that when I kind of fessed up to my Christian Union friends, there was this horror that I was going to the college chapel. It's like, but they're not evangelical. And I was thinking, but that's the place I find going, yeah, but it's all a bit new age, all of this Celtic Christianity. You can't be dabbling with any of that. And I felt completely judged. And I was thinking, but what can I do? Because that is where I find God at this point in time. That is the only thing I can cling on to find any light at the end of my tunnel. And yet I'm being told this is wrong. And then you're thrown into this internal conflict about what is the right way to find God. But that was the only way I was finding God. And I think that's why I like these pictures here, particularly this one. I love these paths where you've got this well-trodden path here, and then you've got this grassy bit here in the middle, and then you've got the thicket all around. And I just think tradition is one of those things that can get us through. It's the well-trodden path. So in a way, it's part of all these pathways that we're reading about. Within all of them, there will be a more traditional way. And that's the one that's easier to go on. That's the one we'll get our kids to walk on when you're going for a walk, because it's easier underfoot. It's clear and it's sure when everything else is thicket all about you. Sometimes I find that there's a pressure in a way to pray modern prayers. And yet I find my mind wanders. And I kind of go into a bit of a panic zone. Oh my gosh, my turn's coming, and what am I going to say that's as articulate as that? And sometimes I just find that if I'm in an environment where there's more of a structure and a liturgy, my mind wanders less, and I find there's less pressure. Obviously, it's then a balancing act again, isn't it? Because you don't want to hide behind a liturgy and not speak from your heart and not share of yourself because you're scared about being hurt. But at the same time, that can then take you into a place where you feel very uncomfortable. So I think, all in all, it's my view that whatever pathway we find easiest at various times in our life to access a fuller relationship with God, it's human nature that we will always do it through an element of ritual and tradition. That's how human beings learn. We will always bring order to our chaos in some way, shape or form. So much as Mark's saying, if you're a traditionalist, you wouldn't be here today. We have our traditions at Network. We have a drawing board. We set the chairs up like this. Do you know what I mean? We have a sharing time. We always divide the service into three bits, and that's what we follow. And that's entirely natural. That is what human beings will do. What we then have to judge is, where does that dictate? How are we able to be flexible and evolve within that structure to allow growth without restricting things? I think also one thing I reflected on was being a parent and the lack of time we spend these days in celebrating feasts and acknowledging the passage of feasts. So our kids don't necessarily know that we're in Lent or whatever. They don't really have that on their radar, particularly if you're not in a more traditional church environment. And I think there's a real responsibility in parents to celebrate those occasions. I think it provides a pastoral work towards your children, and I think it connects them with their Christian heritage to show, you know, it matters what happened in the past. It matters that we're part of something bigger. Right, moving on. Yeah, we can be nourished by certain religious practices. Really like that phrase. And I think that's it. There are those times, aren't there, when you're just getting to something you think that's really nourishing. Like doing a quiet time. It's a really healthy thing. And quite often, you know, Darren will have the place he always goes to, which is the back room normally when it's warm with the skylight open. And that's where we go. The danger is if he's saying, no, I have to be there to do my quiet time. If I'm not there, I can't do it. I just can't connect with God. But it's important to get into those spaces, to have times where we are nourished by religious practices. One of the things I've found is I've been trying to be more disciplined. It's harder, I think, for me to find time in a traditional way of sort of doing a prayer time in the morning, just because of getting the kids out the house. And so I'd initially thought, oh, in September, when the kids go to school, when I come in and have a coffee, that's when I'll do a quiet time. And that hasn't happened. I've ended up doing other things. But then I found I was naturally doing it more at lunchtime. When I have my lunch, I would read a psalm, and I've been sort of working my way through. And then, you know, life happens. A couple of days you've not done it for justifiable reasons. But what's lovely is when it's a healthy kind of ritual, there's no sense of self-condemnation over it. In a sort of, why haven't you done it? Oh, no, I've not done it. And just that sort of worm theology of just feeling dreadful. What's been happening is kind of what I've heard Karen, the phrase Karen's used before, of a wooing. And there's just like this sort of nudging of the Holy Spirit of, you know, you've not come and spent any time with me today. And it's like, oh, no, I haven't. And it's lovely because it draws you back in and you do it and it brings you, pulls you back to that rhythm and that cycle. And I think it's really important that we all find that sort of natural rhythm without it feeling forced. Right, so I wanted to move on and talk about symbols. And this is quite interesting because I think people can have quite a strong reaction to the idea of symbology and what that means. because we're saved by faith. We don't need symbols, we're saved by faith. And I get all of that. And obviously, historically, symbols were very important. You know, times of persecution, people used symbols as secret signs that a meeting was going on and what have you. So they're very, very relevant, very, very important. And I'd say now they still are relevant, but they're kind of objects invested with an inner meaning, which is very personal. So one of the things I was thinking of is, as a lover of nature and literature, I find symbols very powerful for me, and almost prophetic. And it's a family joke. Things happen, I'm having to make a big decision. If stuff happens, I always say, is it a sign? Do you think it's a sign? Is it a sign? Because I love signs, they're really important. And I hadn't realised quite how much, so I was chatting to my sister about this recently, and she said, oh, you were always into signs. Even when we were little girls, you were into signs. And I said, really? And she said, oh, yeah. She said, particularly rainbows. You're always going on about rainbows being a sign that God wouldn't flood the world. Because I can remember, I did get really upset. What would I do? It was when people started first talking about global warming, and it came onto my radar as a child, and I thought, well, what would we do if the world flooded and there was no land and all of this? And then you see the rainbow and think, hang on, God's promised he'll never do that again. And I was like, oh, yes, that's right. This big sigh of relief. And to me, I found it really interesting. Karen mentioned in her sermon the other week about red kites being prophetic. They're really, really important for me. And it all started off very sort of minor because it was the only bird of prey I could identify. Of course, there are actually quite a lot round here, more on the M40, but there are quite a lot. Then what I noticed is that at times in my life when I'm particularly feeling under threat, I will see particular things with red kites. And that's a very personal symbol, but very important. And they'll be in really weird places as well. So you know it's not just a random sighting of red kites because there's loads of them around. So a good example is times I've felt that... Darren and mine's relationship has been being attacked or is under threat. You know, I was at the lawn tennis club and I was really low and I was really down over it and kind of a bit browbeaten and thinking, you know, what's going on? And I look up and there's two red kites right overhead me in the middle of the lawn tennis club. And I was just like, oh, wow. And it's like there were two. And I thought, that's great. It's like we're kind of soaring together. And then last summer, to top it all off, and I couldn't find a photo of this actually, which shows you just how rare it must be. Oh, there you go. Yeah, my two red kites. Last summer, before we went to Revive, I was just feeling really lonely and isolated and exhausted from sort of treading a different path to the world and couldn't really understand what was going on and just wanted to get the tent and go. And I remember saying to Darren, I just want to pack the car up with the tent now and just head for the hills. I've had enough now. And it was that sense, I just want to gather my chicks and just go. I've just had enough. And then we were stood in our back garden, me and the kids. They were just playing, and I looked up, and there were five red kites over my house. Five of them. And I was just like, oh, my goodness, wow. And it was like this confirmation that the Lord was saying, yeah, you know, you're a family unit. You need to be together. This is a time for you to be together. And I've never seen five since. And so I was very excited by that. So, yes, symbols, I think, really important. But we need to remember they are a reminder. They're not the centre of our faith. They are a reminder of things. And I think they bring a kind of poetry to our worship, which I like. Sacrifice. Now, I was just thinking about this, actually. I was cuddling my boys during worship. Tristan had Marmite on toast for breakfast. There's a nice whiff of Marmite as I kind of nuzzling him. And I said, oh, so I'm mentioning Marmite in my sermon. Because I think things like sacrifice, we often think of worship as an element of the service in which we can bring sacrifice. And yet, I would say worship is one of the things, one of the traditions which can cause most division within a church. Because we all have personal preferences as to what type of music we like, what hymns we like, for personal reasons, just for general reasons. And sometimes you'll get worship that's reduced to simply being an emotional expression. And it's kind of what I call Marmite worship. You either love it or you hate it. And you'll have quite a strong reaction to it, as you do with Marmite. And we need to be careful as to how far we take that extreme, that personal preference, and how much we go to foist that on others. It was making me laugh because my sister, I should say this, it's being recorded, but her father-in-law is quite a particular man, and he will only serve cream if it's whipped, because it's better because it's been aerated. It tastes better. And even though my sister has said very politely over the years, I really would prefer my cream poured, it has to be whipped, because I'm telling you that is the way it has to be served. So she doesn't get what she wants. She has to have whipped cream. And nobody will get him to change his mind. And I just thought it's a good example, you know, people saying, this is the way we're going to do worship, because it has to be this way. This is the right way. It's such dangerous ground. It's one thing to say, I have a personal preference for it to be like this. I have a personal preference for being like that. That particular song was very important to me. And you have to be very sensitive to each other. You can't just diss someone else's preference, even though you're sat there thinking, I hate that song. I think the lyrics are awful. Musically, it's dreadful. If someone's sharing of their heart, that got me through a really difficult time. We have to extend grace to one another. We can't just leap in with that type of thing. And I think that the challenge is, I found this great phrase actually in the book that we're reading, all sacrifices are offerings, but not all offerings are sacrifices. And I thought that was something to bear in mind. So, this. So,
Trevor's going, but I'm thinking.
Yeah. All sacrifices are offerings. Well, whatever we bring is an offering. You know, it's like going to a birthday party. Yeah. This is someone who's speaking whose gift, whose love language is gifts.
Yeah.
No pressure, Darren. No pressure. I cannot stand offerings that aren't sacrifices, that are ill thought out. I feel absolutely rejected and unknown. Darren knows this to his cost. When we first got together, our first Christmas, we were just dating. He bought me this Christmas present. And I can remember thinking, that's it, the relationship's over, because he clearly doesn't know me if he's going to buy me that, because that's just not me. This sort of need to feel known. And I was just appalled at this offering. And I was just like, my dad's there going, give the guy a chance, you know. Not like, I know that's it. You know, it's a sign, it's not meant to be. Whereas, you know,
it wasn't that bad.
It was lavender scented toiletries.
No.
He's just dying. So I think that's my point, is that you can bring anything that's an offering, a bit like Cain and Abel. But if one is an actual sacrifice for you to give, then it's pleasing to God. Whereas if it's just an offering, like it's just any old thing that you've taken along, that doesn't mean it's a sacrifice. It is an offering nonetheless, but it's not. It's the heart behind it. And I think that's the essence of what I'm sharing today, is what we need to always do is look to our own hearts and look to the hearts of the people leading things that might be more traditional to see what's going on. You know, I can remember when we were first married, and it always happens, doesn't it, when you're first married, you get into the whole sort of, there's like this convergence of family rituals and how things are done. And I can remember our big flashpoint was Christmas, because Christmas was a big deal in my parents' house. We always did Christmas. And it was, you know, the cut glass was out. It was a real feast. And yet Darren's parents are really puritanical. We go to church. Yeah. You know, when there's people starving in the world, we shouldn't be. And I just felt really guilty. And I thought, but I love having a nice fatted calf at Christmas. You know, this is dreadful. And, you know, we then start doing things like, it's got to be a real Christmas tree. Oh, we've always had an artificial one. I'm like, no, it's got to be real, because the smell is like, that's Christmas. And we've got to have Quality Street, and we have to open them on the day that we decorate the tree, and it's the rustle in the tin and the smell. And Darren's going, but I don't like Quality Street. They're really nasty. And I'm going, oh, it's got to be Quality Street. And you've got these competing rituals. And Darren, very wisely, of course, being a nine, cuts and goes, no. He did give in on the Quality Street, and I now have the children on my side. But he did say quite rightly, but we're meant to find our own traditions now. You know, leaving and cleaving, we find our own traditions. And that was really hard for me. It was deeply upsetting to leave some of those traditions behind. He was very loving about it. He was like, but we're not replicating what you've had as a child for the rest of our lives. You know, it has to be what we do now. Let's find our own way. And I was a bit, oh, I just want to follow the path that I like. He was like, no, let's go and find our own way. Loads.
Yeah.
Loads.
Giving presents and getting into debt. Where does it say that in the Bible?
Absolutely. It certainly doesn't. I mean, I was thinking about it in the context of Easter.
Yeah.
You know, we're all really looking forward to Easter. But I mean, nowhere in the Bible does it say, you know, you must celebrate Easter.
No, or Lent.
None of those things. And I think that's where I came out with my point going towards being parents. Yes, it doesn't say to do that, but it's very important. I always link it back to, going back to university. And I did a special subject in my third year, which was on the First Crusade. It was absolutely epic. It was brilliant. A really charismatic tutor as well. He was fantastic. In his day, he used to hang out with the Rolling Stones and things. He was a funny bloke. But one of the things he'd done, one of his research, major piece of research with one of his students, a PhD student, was looking at the Crusader ideology, and looking at families. And you often found that it was certain families that went on crusade, and all the sons would go on crusade, and it kind of just seemed to go down. And he was looking at that, and what he discovered is it all came from the women. And it was women born into Crusader families who, when they married, their sons would go on crusade. And it was really interesting to me that it's women who carry the ideology, and that's what they're going to give to their children. And I just felt particularly challenged by that when looking at this and celebrating Easter and Lent and Holy Week and what does it mean. They're really important things that as parents, as grandparents, we can pass down to our kids as a tradition, which is a positive thing. It's bringing God into the world, in a way. In medieval times, in a way, it was easier, wasn't it? Because a lot more of the church was involved in, the passing of the seasons and harvest and things like that. It marked the sort of passage of time during the year. We don't do that so much now because people just aren't connected in church in the same way. It doesn't have that role. But we can still mark these feasts and talk about it. So one of the things we feel very strongly about in our family is Good Friday. The kids are all up for Easter Sunday, and most of us think we can just do the Easter thing on one day, on Sunday, and then it's done. And we thought, but that kind of misses the really biggie of Good Friday. And last year we went to St Mary's in Kingsbourne Green. I don't know if they're doing it this year. Do you know if they're doing the children's one? They usually do, but they do a brilliant Good Friday service at 3 p.m. for kids to go to, which was marvellous. Because when you do find Good Friday services to go to, they're really traditional. And people are very, very sombre, with good reason. And you feel very awkward taking kids in that environment because they're not going to be quiet. They're going to be asking questions. And then we were tipped off about this service at St Mary's last year, which was brilliant. And so they did the Stations of the Cross, truncated it to just a few of them, for kids. And they moved the chairs, and Becky had them all sat down on carpets going round. And they were encouraged to ask questions. And there was just this really sombre mood still, because it was all pictures of, Gethsemane, the trial, Jesus being flogged, all the full-on stuff. But the children were able to ask questions, and it was accessible to them, and we felt it was really important to mark that as part of our Christian heritage. Otherwise, it just gets lost. We forget about these things. So, what I hope we can do is, rather than seeing trappings of traditionalism as a distraction, let's look for ways in which it might enhance our own personal pathways, what things we find. So next week, or not next week of the prayer meeting, but when you get to it in cell, we're really behind. One of the things I was going to suggest, things that we can share in cell, is how has a traditional pathway helped or hindered your own journey or relationship with God? I think that would be a really interesting exercise. Just hear more of each of the stories. What backgrounds have we come from? What have we found positive or negative? Why do we react in a particular way when we go into a church building? Be it positive or negative, what's that mean? What are your traditions? Talk about your own quiet times and that sort of thing. What things do you find easy, helpful? Equally, where do you struggle to maintain a rhythm so that we can pray into this with each other? Where do you struggle to find that sort of rhythm where you can regularly find a way to connect with God? Another thing you might want to do is to share personal symbols with each other. Again, that's more going back to sharing part of your own journey and story. And finally, what do you think we can learn from our heritage rather than assuming out with the old and in with the new? Is there anything? Anything or nothing?
Thank you very much, Rebecca. I think there's an awful lot to think about there, wasn't there? It just struck me that however sort of non-traditional you feel you are, if you think about it, well, we all had to come to faith in some particular way, and that probably meant somebody was involved, whether our parents or a church leader or a group of friends, you know, from university or whatever it was. And then you think, well, how did they come to faith? Well, then they had parents, they had preachers, they had whatever. And you go back another generation, how did they come to faith? And if you bother to find out, it probably goes all the way back to the apostles, doesn't it? You know, so we're all the product of a tradition, however much we feel we don't want to be involved in the sort of, if you like, the paraphernalia of tradition. Yes, there's a lot to think of there.